I'm excited to be here today. How about you? All right. So a few days ago, my twins were playing with a kid from down the street, and they decided that a great idea for three little boys would be to sing karaoke on my daughter's karaoke machine. And that went amazing for like 30 seconds until their friend decided he wanted the microphone and tried to yank it out of Billy's hand and succeeded only in yanking the cord hard enough to snap it in half. And I didn't know any of this was going on. I was in a different room, but I heard the front door slam and watched the neighbor kid sprinting back toward his house in a t-shirt and thought, he forgot his coat. That's weird. And so I went in to ask the twins what happened, and Billy held up the two broken pieces of the cord and said, well, I was singing and he wanted it, and so he tried to yank it and it broke. And then Tommy chimed in, yeah, he made this face. And then he ran. And I almost died laughing because I so relate to that kid in that moment. Have you ever done something dumb and just panicked and ran? Or broken something, had the Tommy Boy moment where like you tried to fake it and put it back together so the next person who touched it thought it was their fault? What'd you do? Panic and run, panic and fake it, panic and lie. I've sadly been there. I remember a time when we were kids, my brother and I were playing a game of tag using a giant exercise ball. Like if you got hit by the ball, you were it. And he ran into my parents' room and I whipped it at him and smoked him straight in the head. But then it bounced right off his bowl-cutted hair across the room into my mom's precious moments. And we made this face and took off running. And a little while later, my mom asked me if I knew anything about how one of her precious moments could have been broken. And I wish that I could stand here and tell you that I had the character and the integrity to just tell the truth. But I didn't want to get in trouble. I was afraid. And so I just said, whew, I have no idea. That's a head scratcher. The girls could have been. And dad's a diabetic. Sometimes he has those reactions, low blood sugar. He might have stumbled into it. Who could know? And then she informed me that James had already told her the story. So cool. First of all, thanks, James, so much. Second of all, thanks, Mom, for setting me up. Like, what do you do in that moment? You keep digging. And you're just like, well, Mom, he touched it last. It went off his head. And if he didn't have that ridiculous bowl cut, if he had normal hair, it might have bounced in a different direction. This is kind of your fault, Mom, for that. I don't know. Panic can make you stupid. And stupidity in life often ends up costing us and the people around us pretty dearly. So last week, we kicked off this brand new series called The Warrior Poet, and we've been taking a look at the life of David. And if you weren't here, you can catch up on the app or the podcast on Facebook or YouTube. But real quick recap, we met David. He walked onto the pages of history in a really counterintuitive, countercultural way. There's a guy named King Saul, and he had failed to be the leader God called him to be, the leader that Israel needed. And so God rejected him as king and said, his reign is coming to an end. I'm going to appoint an entirely different person to be the next king over Israel. And so he sent the prophet Samuel to the town of Bethlehem to anoint one of the sons of Jesse as the next king. And Jesse paraded seven of his sons before Samuel. These seven big, tall, handsome, king-looking dudes, and every time God said, no, not him, no, not him, no, not him. And so finally they dragged in the youngest son, the runt of the litter, the guy who did not look the part, and God said, he's the one. I don't look at what you look at. People get so caught up in focusing on the externals, but I look at the heart. So the first lesson God taught us from David's life is that who we are matters infinitely more than how we appear. And that lesson got reinforced just a little while later as David showed up at a battlefield and watched this massive giant warrior named Goliath walk out onto the field and challenge anybody to come fight him and curse the nation of Israel and curse God. And David realized that on the outside it looked like a pretty significant mismatch, but on the inside he was full of faith. And so he courageously trusted in God's provision, charged out on the field, and slayed the giant. And it was incredible. I mean, he became a national hero. At the age of 15, he was like a legend, and they started singing songs about him. Saul has killed his thousands, David his tens of thousands. And Saul heard that stuff, and he's like, man, this kid has a lot of potential. But he also has a lot of power and a lot of influence. We got to understand this about Saul. He was incredibly insecure. He was outrageously protective of his own power and unsure of himself and completely selfish. And so he looks at David and decides to do that thing where you keep your enemies close and your friend's close and your enemy's closer. And so he tries to keep David close by offering him his oldest daughter in marriage. And David tells Saul, I'm 15, man. I don't think so. This is not the right time, and that's weird, and I don't think I should be the king's son-in-law. I don't know. And then everyone loves him even more. They're like, oh, how humble. Who would do that? What a kid. And so Saul has to bring him close by making him a military commander. And so he kind of makes David the captain of this special forces unit and gives him these special missions to go on. And eventually, because David is spending so much time hanging out with the royal family, he falls in love with Saul's youngest daughter, Michal, and they get married. And he becomes best friends with Saul's oldest son, Jonathan. And Saul recognizes that, and he steps back and says, maybe it was a huge mistake to bring this kid in close, because everybody seems to love him more than they love me, even my family. And he gets insanely jealous of David. So insanely jealous that he decides, I gotta kill this kid. But he doesn't want to be the one to kill him, because everybody in Israel likes David and he's afraid they'll reject him or kill him. So he just sends him on more and more dangerous missions, hoping that the enemies of Israel will kill David in battle. Except David is super good at battle. He just keeps winning, baby. And then everyone loves him even more. They're like, man, this guy. And so Saul's plan is failing miserably. And so he tries to get some of his like most loyal commanders to arrest David in secret and dispose of him. But every time he makes a plan to do that, David gets tipped off by his wife or his best friend, who happen to be Saul's kids, and he slips through Saul's grasp. And so eventually Saul's like, I don't know, nothing else is working. Maybe I should just throw a spear at him while he's not looking. And David's sitting there playing the harp one day, and Saul whips a spear at him, and David ducks because David has cat-like reflexes, and it's just not going good. And what's incredible about this story is that while Saul is doing this, while all this is going on, David remains incredibly loyal to him. Keeps going on missions, keeps risking his life for Saul, never undermines him or tries to undercut his authority or tries to replace him as king. He does what so many of us wouldn't do and just says, okay, God, I'm going to keep serving this guy as long as you have him as king. And it should wake Saul up to the fact that David isn't that bad of a guy, but it doesn't. His rage just grows and grows and grows until one day it explodes. He's got a plan for some guys to rush in and seize David at dinner. And back in the day, being invited to dinner with the king was a big deal. Like, nobody missed it. Everybody's in their place, except David's chair is empty. And Saul loses it. He's like, where is David? And Jonathan, his son, who loves David and wants to protect him from the evil his father's about to do, makes some more excuses for David. And Saul blows up at him. We read in 1 Samuel chapter 20 that Saul screams at him, you son of a perverse and rebellious woman. Don't I know you've sided with the son of Jesse to your shame and the shame of the mother who bore you? That's quite a dinner insult, you guys. Especially considering, as best we understand this passage, the perverse, rebellious woman who gave birth to Jonathan, Saul's wife, is sitting right there. It's a family dinner. It's awkward. I can't imagine that went down well later. I just feel like if I screamed at one of my kids, like, curse the perverse, rebellious woman who bore you, Jenny would be not pleased later. There's some marriage issues going on there, right? And to be fair, there were marriage issues going on a lot of the time back then because they lived in a culture where, like, you read all these stories in the Bible, somebody had a favorite wife and a least favorite wife and then your middle favorite wives. And I just think you probably don't want to be living in a culture where you have a favorite wife. That's a thought for another day, though. Anyways, Saul yells. He declares he's going to hunt down David and kill him if it's the last thing he does, and he storms out. And Jonathan's really worried, and so he goes and he finds David, and he's like, man, you got to get out of here. He's serious this time. He's so caught up in himself and his own power. He's so jealous of who you are and of your influence. He's going to stop at nothing. You got to run. I love you, man. Please go. And David panics and flees. And this is the point of the story where we're going to kind of slow down and zoom in on what happens next. And I love the life of David, and I love the way the Bible tells it, both its ups and its downs, because there's so much for us to learn in about who we are, and even more than that, about who God is and how he relates to us. And we're going to follow along kind of the roller coaster of David's life today. We have seen him make it to the top, and he's about to crash all the way to the bottom. He has two kind of epic major failures in his life. I mean, he sprinkles in some other mistakes along the way, but two really big ones. One of them happens in his 50s, and that's kind of a famous one if you grew up in or around the church at all. And we're going to get to that later in this series, but this one happens in his 20s. This is like 6 or 7 years after he killed Goliath, and right now he's a 22-year-old kid running afraid for his life, and he feels like he's been rejected and abandoned by this guy he's been risking his life for again and again and again, and he's mad because this isn't his fault and he didn't do anything wrong, and he almost feels like he's been abandoned and hung out to dry by the nation he's been fighting for. Last week we talked about how David's story shows us the character that can slay giants. This week, we're going to take a look at the giants that can slay character. Namely, these giants we call anger, fear, and isolation. And here's what we're going to see in David, what I hope we'll realize in ourselves this morning. Like, following God, walking in the ways we know he's called us to, can seem really unappealing and really counterintuitive in the moments where we're gripped by fear and anger and isolation. Because for all of us, those feelings drive us to a place of panic. We know, every single one of us, what it is to be so panicked that our sense of fear overwhelms, like, not only what we know we ought to do, but who we want to be. When we're mad, when we feel like we're experiencing injustice, when we're terrified about this unknown future that lies out ahead of us, when we feel like we're completely alone, we get driven to a point where we make decisions that we wouldn't normally make, where we crash past every boundary we've ever set up for ourselves, both morally and ethically. And some of that stuff leads to our greatest regrets. I mean, chances are, if we spent some time this morning, like just a couple minutes, thinking about our hugest mistakes, the moments we wish we could just take an eraser and scrub from our history as human beings, the things that we did in those moments are probably tied to one of these three giants: anger or fear or isolation, or maybe some combination of them, to this crushing weight that we felt and choices we made in an attempt to alleviate that tension, choices that backfired spectacularly and left us angrier, lonelier, and scareder? That was not a word, but we're rolling with it. So this is David right here as he's running for his life for King Saul. And we're going to pick up his story in the book of 1 Samuel chapter 21. So if you have a Bible or a Bible with you right now, you can crack it open there. If not, you can follow along with the words on the screen or in the Revision app. And if you need a Bible, if you don't own one, please take one from the Next Steps table before you go. They're free. We love it when they disappear. But this is what's going on. 1 Samuel chapter 21. David's panicked and he's running. And we read, David went to Nob. That's a city, not a person. It's hard to tell in the Bible sometimes. David went to Nob to Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him and asked, "Why are you alone? Why is no one with you?" A quick bit of context here. At this point in history, Jerusalem didn't quite belong to the nation of Israel yet. It hadn't been conquered. And so the priest, the high priest Ahimelech, and all the rest of the priests lived wherever the tabernacle, this tent that they'd set up as the temple in the wilderness was. And at this point in time, it was at Nob. And so that's where David went to inquire of the high priest. And this isn't the first time he's been there. It's just the first time he's been there by himself. And Ahimelech's not a dumb guy. Like, David was the captain of like 1,000-man special forces unit. You usually heard him coming before you saw him. And he shows up kind of disheveled and all alone. And the priest is like, "This is weird. This is a little bit crazy. What's going on?" And David lies straight to his face. He answers him, "The king sent me on a mission, super secret, special mission, not supposed to tell anybody about it. And yeah, I'm not actually alone. My men are there. I told them to meet me at a certain place. So you got any food that I can have?" Because this is a terrible lie. This isn't even a good lie. If you're going to lie, you should lie better than this. This is one of history's worst ever lies. He's just making it up as he goes along. And I think part of the reason David is so bad at lies is that David is against lying. He knows, it's like one of the big 10, thou shalt not lie. And ironically enough, he's lying to the priest standing in the tabernacle. From where he tells that lie, he can see this big, huge curtain in front of him, and he knows right behind that curtain is the Ark of the Covenant, and inside that ark are the stone tablets on which God wrote down the Ten Commandments. David is a few feet away from the original copy, and he's lying like a lie-faced liar. Why? Because he's scared, and he's mad, and he feels like he's all alone. And again, Ahimelech's not a moron, and so he's thinking, okay, dude, you're leading a military camp? You look like you haven't slept in days, and apparently your army's going to meet you at a certain place, and you forgot to pack food. This is weird. And it is weird, but we got to understand, David's David. At this point in time, he had earned some trust, and he'd earned a little bit of leeway, and so Ahimelech looks at him and says, well, we don't have any normal bread or any normal food. All we have is the priestly bread, the special bread that's used as part of the offering ceremony that nobody is allowed to eat except the priests. But man, if you promise me that you're ceremonially clean and you're good with God, I'll give you that bread. I think God would be okay with that, even though technically it's against the rules. And so David takes the bread, and then he asks Ahimelech, don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapons because the king's mission was urgent. Right now we're getting borderline ridiculous. The most famous warrior in all of Israel forgot his weapon on a military mission. I can promise you this, if he was serving at Guantanamo Bay under Colonel Nathan Jessup, he would have got a code red for that stuff. But here's David can't handle the truth, so he just keeps on lying. And Ahimelech's like, you don't even have a weapon? And the fact that he has to make that up probably should have woken David up to what's going on, especially because of what happens next. We're going to witness something incredibly powerful, this moment where David is figuratively transported back in time to the sights and the smells and the memories that have shaped him into who he is. And like right here, right now, David ought to understand what's going on. He ought to snap out of it and ask, what am I doing? Why am I saying this? Why am I even considering this? But here's what actually happens. Ahimelech looks at him and says, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, whom you killed in the Valley of Elah is here. It's wrapped in cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one. Guys, this is nuts. If this were a movie, this is when like the dramatic music would be playing, and then David would have a flashback to that day in the field as Ahimelech tells him, look, the only sword we got is the one that you used to slay the giant. That day when you believed God would provide for you no matter what. That day when the faith inside of you was bigger than the giant in front of you. It's kind of interesting. Originally, David had kept Goliath's sword as a souvenir. And who wouldn't? It's a pretty sweet souvenir. But eventually he started realizing that he was getting puffed up with pride. And so he had this thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take the sword to the temple. I'm going to dedicate it to the temple so it can be kept there as a reminder. Number one, to myself, that I did not kill Goliath by my own power, but by God's power. He just wanted to remember always that he was completely dependent on God. And number two, as a reminder to the nation of Israel, we're going to keep it there at the temple so that we all don't forget that God is faithful to keeping his promises, and he always shows up for us. You guys, that is why the sword is at the temple. David put it there for that reason, which means when Ahimelech like hands him the sword, it ought to be a powerful personal reminder to him of who God is and who God called him to be, of how God always shows up and God always provides. But he just can't see it. He's so blinded to it. He's been separated from his wife and his home and his family and his job and his friends and his warriors and his country. And he's just angry and he's feeling abandoned. And so he looks at the sword and says, Goliath's sword, there is none like it. Give it to me. Really? There's none like it? What happened to the kid who charged the field with clear eyes and a full heart, who saw that exact sword gleaming in the sun and told the giant, you're coming at me with a sword? I'm coming at you in the name of the Lord of hosts. What happened to the poet who wrote, when I'm afraid, I put my trust in you, in God whose word I praise, in God I trust and am not afraid. What can mere mortals do to me? The poet who wrote, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. What happened to that guy? Here's what happened. His character and his faith were slain by the giants of fear and anger and isolation. And so he took the sword that he had once used to slay a giant. And he should have seen it, grabbing a hold of that flawed weapon that wasn't enough to protect a mighty warrior from a boy with a stone and a sling. But in the moment, he just couldn't see it. And I read it and I think, oh man, this is so my story. And maybe it's yours too. This is where we see ourselves in David so much. Fear and insecurity are so overwhelming when they hit. They just feel so heavy, and then they're constantly trying to get us to settle for lesser things, to grab hold of a smaller future than the one God says we were made for. And Goliath's sword is awesome. No doubt about it. David is correct. There's not another sword like it, but it's a lesser thing. And he, of all people, should have known that that sword was less powerful than the mighty hand of God. I look back at my own life and see so many times of fear and isolation and anger and panic. And I just think all of us, we have this tendency when we're feeling that way to settle for lesser things, to make decisions and choices where we throw our moral compass out the window and decide, you know, I got to do what I got to do. Like, it's easy to trust in God when there's not much on the line. It's easy to trust in God when we don't need him in a moment or feel like we need him, when there's not much to trust him for. But when the pressure comes, I think it's so much easier for us as human beings to trust in that sword, to trust in the thing that's in our hand, our capability and our ingenuity and our own power and our strength and our money, and say, like, I got to manipulate this situation. I will lie, cheat, and steal to bend it to my will. I don't know if I can trust God. I got to trust in me. And we do it because, like, fear and anger and loneliness are heavy, and it feels like they're constantly nearby. I had lunch with a friend on Wednesday, and we were talking about how sometimes it feels like we're living life just on a razor's edge between hope and despair. And it doesn't take very much to push us off the ledge on either side. It feels like no matter how much success we've had in the past, no matter how many times God has shown up for us, no matter how many giants we've conquered, it just doesn't sustain us for very long. The confidence we had doesn't carry us. Like, no matter what measure of greatness and what measure of God's power has been part of our story, it never seems to inoculate us to fear, to feeling scared and insignificant and abandoned. Like, even on the outside, in the moments where we feel like, you know, we kind of got it together, where people would look at us and say, wow, I want his life, I want her life, she's got it all. We're just never far from panic. It wells up inside of us every time we forget who God is and what God's promised us. That's what happened to David. He went on the run because he forgot who God had been to him every moment of his entire life, and he forgot what God had promised him. He had this moment where he doubted that the God who had saved him from bears and saved him from lions and saved him from giants and saved him from enemies was going to save him from Saul. Where he doubted that the God who promised he'd be the next king was actually going to deliver. He thought, maybe God's a liar. I better take this into my own hands. And here's how that worked out for him. He ended up in the territory of the Philistines. He actually strolled into Goliath's hometown carrying Goliath's sword. You guys will be shocked to learn some people there weren't very happy about that, and they thought, we should kill him. Then he panicked again. He's like, oh, great, this was a bad choice. I seem to be making bad decisions. And so he thought, maybe the best way to get out of here is just pretend I'm crazy. And so he started scratching wood with his fingernails, like getting splintered. Oh, can you even imagine that? And then he let snot and spit and drool run down his beard because he thought, maybe they'll think I'm such a weirdo and be so creeped out by me that they just let me get out of here with my life. This is a true story. It's in the Bible. This is a crazy, funny book. You should read it. Seriously, you should read it. So David, like, fakes like he's crazy, and the king is like, I got enough weirdos in this town already. Get him out of here. And he barely escapes with his life. Not with his dignity, but with his life. Ahimelech, though, not so lucky. See, it turns out that day when they were having a conversation in the tabernacle, they weren't the only two there. Saul's chief shepherd, a guy named Doeg, was also there. And he went back to Saul and told him, hey, man, the priest gave David food and gave David a weapon. And Saul is furious. He calls Ahimelech to him and he's like, how dare you help my enemy? And in this moment, Ahimelech is stunned. He's like, your enemy? David had lied to him. He had no idea. He's like, look, man, he's your son-in-law. He's the captain of your bodyguard. Who in the world is a more loyal servant to you than David? He told me he was on a mission for you. That's all that I knew. But Saul is so blinded with rage and jealousy that he orders Ahimelech killed, and not just him, but all 85 priests who live at Nob and their entire families. And in this moment, his military commanders and his officials are like, no, Like, he did nothing wrong. We will fight wars for you, but we will not kill priests and women and children. We won't do it. But Doeg wants a little bit more power. Doeg wants a little bit more wealth. Doeg wants to get in good with the king, and so he decides to become Doeg the bounty hunter, and he hunts down 85 priests and their families, massacres hundreds of people. Only one of them escapes, Ahimelech's son Abiathar, and he makes his way to David and tells him what happened. So it lets him know that this slaughter has occurred, and only then, finally, does David get it. Only then does he realize the consequences of his faithfulness, these panicked actions that it cost him his dignity and hundreds of people their lives, because he thought it wouldn't be a big deal to tell a little white lie. And he weeps humbly to Abiathar. He tells him, that day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he'd be sure to tell Saul. I am responsible for the death of your whole family. And the scar from that, it lasts. David carries it with him for the rest of his life. It just kind of becomes a permanent part of his story, but he learns something in the process. He actually sat down a little bit after this whole thing happened and wrote a song about it, about what Doeg had done and who he was versus what David had learned about who God is. And this is part of that song. At first, he's talking about Doeg. He says, here now was the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others. But I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever. And later in his life, he wrote, the Lord is a refuge for the oppressed, a stronghold in times of trouble. Those who know your name trust in you, for you, Lord, have never forsaken those who seek you. Never forsaken. This was a painful lesson for David to learn as his fear and his anger and his isolation crushed his faith and his character that day. But what he learned about who God is and how God loves is so valuable, not just to him, but to every single one of us who's trying to navigate life in a shattered world. And I think if we could sum it up like in one sentence, like the big idea of this story is this. I made it into a poem for you guys. We're in a series called The Warrior Poet. It's the least I could do. You're welcome. Here it is. If you think you're forsaken, you're completely mistaken. If you think you're forsaken, when you think it, when you have those times where it feels like maybe God has forgotten about you, he hasn't. He's there, and he's worth trusting in, and he's worth trusting in more than your fears are worth trusting in. So here's the thing about fear. It isn't grounded in reality. It's grounded in potential. It's grounded in these thoughts that we have about like terrible things that might possibly be waiting for us up ahead. And so often when times get tough, we lean more into our fear than we lean into our faith. All of us do. Like, fear isn't real, but it feels so real that it cripples us, no matter who we are, no matter where we're at on our faith journey. I talk to people all the time, and I have some really close friends who are agnostic or atheists, and they just talk about faith, and they say, well, you know, we've kind of evolved past that. Haven't we moved beyond faith as a species? And I ask them really earnestly, have you moved beyond fear? Like, seriously, have you outgrown fear? Because for me, I would really like to outgrow fear before I outgrow faith. I just don't see a whole lot of benefit to maintaining a relationship with this thing that creates a whole lot of negativity in me as I think about the future. I see a great deal of benefit in maintaining something that creates positivity in me as I relate to the future. There's a whole lot more for me in aiming my life in the direction of hope and joy and love and reality than there is in aiming my life towards tragic potentiality. But it's hard. It's hard because fear, in the end, fear is faith. It is. It's just the dark side of faith. Fear is faith in the worst possible future, and it causes us, just like David, to think we're running for our lives when really what we're doing is running from our lives. We're running from the God who promises he will never forsake us, from the God who loved us so much that he stepped into the human story and gave his life so that we could be forgiven and set free, from the God who's promised never to just leave us in the spaces where we're left to our own panicked choices. But it's so easy to feel like we're in those spaces. So easy to decide that because of the stuff that's going on in our lives, because we're not in control, we just got to lie, cheat, steal, panic, and do everything we can to get ourselves out of there. And sometimes that feels like the right choice. Sometimes when we're angry and we're scared and we're feeling all alone, it feels good to lean into those giants. It feels like, man, I don't want to. This isn't who I want to be, but I got to do it right now. The problem is that even though it feels good, it never turns out good for you or for anybody else. So the question is, what do you do when those giants attack? Because they're going to attack. They're real and they're coming for every single one of us. When you're mad, when you're scared, when you're lonely, and you begin to think about doing things you know you shouldn't do. You begin to consider things you never would have considered before because you're just panicked relationally, financially, emotionally, physically. You get tempted to do things you got no business doing that don't reflect at all who it is you want to be. What do we do? David was 22 years old. He was caught between a rock and a hard place, angry and alone. And fueled by fear, he made some decisions that cost him and cost a whole bunch of other people really dearly. And he didn't mean for it to happen. That's just the way the world works. And that's the way it works for us, too. Like your future, but not just yours. The future of the people whose lives you're crashing into hangs in the balance. And I believe that if David were here today, what he would say to you, what he would say to me, what he would say to all of us as we face down a broken world that's full of giants is if you think you're forsaken, you're completely mistaken. Completely mistaken. Like 1,000 years after this story we read about today, David's most famous descendant, who was born in the town of David, stood up in front of a whole bunch of oppressed, angry, hungry, frightened, abandoned people, and he told them, come to me. You know how David promised you that the Lord is a refuge? That's me. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you, like my perspective, my worldview, my love. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. You guys, if we just believe that, I believe it would change everything about the darkest, scariest, most isolating times in our lives if we just believe that we are never abandoned, that no matter what the world throws at us, no matter what giants are in front of us, they got nothing on us because we got Jesus with us. Will you pray with me? God, thank you for never abandoning us. We live in a broken, scary world, and it's easy to feel alone, and it's easy to feel angry, and it's easy to feel scared, and it's easy to be overwhelmed by all of that and to start trusting in our own power, our own brilliance, or our own tools. And God, so often, I mean, so many of us have just deep regrets because of the choices we made when we did that. And so I just pray that you give us confidence today that if we come to you, we'll find rest. That if we feel forsaken, we're completely mistaken because you're here and you're present and you love us. And we just thank you. Thank you for your love that changes everything about our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.